and officially welcome to this lecture. And we started to kind of just look at some programming exercise and how this exercise translates, example program translates into machine code. So what was the example? The example was a semaphore. And so I like this example because for two things. First, it is one cute algorithm which uses wait and mutex. And that is the one thing. And so I always, this is one thing. And it is also provides us with extra insights, namely semaphore is something like, in some sense, you could think of it as a higher level concept, which allows for more sophisticated protocols beyond just locking and unlocking. And so what is specific with the semaphore? So for the semaphore, you do not just have a Boolean choice. Either you may proceed or you may be blocked. But a semaphore allows to count down a certain, as if there are multiple resources, and so let more than one thread pass, and only then, if resources are exhausted, then the further entering or approaching arriving threads are blocked and put into a waiting queue, and when the resources are freed again, then they may proceed. So that's kind of the philosophy of the semaphore. But by the way, at least, so I do this, I have shown that in Java, and we made little examples in Java with semaphores. And I think the semaphore thread libraries also provide a fixed pre-implementation of semaphores, so you do not have to do it on your own. If one sees in real programming examples, actually I must say I have never seen the semaphore with other values than 0 and 1. And if it has only 0 and 1, then it's more or less like a lock. In some sense it's a bit sad, but that this nice concept is only used in this deprived version. So we have last time looked at how to initialize a semaphore, and initializing a semaphore in essentially meant just to create a new mutex, to create a new condition variable, and put them into a struct. And that's exactly this code. Here the new mutex is created and stored in the semaphore, and here the new condition variable is created and also stored in the corresponding field of the semaphore, and then here this is then the counter, which is also initialized and put into the corresponding field, this time with relative address 2 of the semaphore. That was it. So that was simple. And now let's see how the other functionalities are realized. So I said there are two, this P and the V operation with this strange Dutch names, which I call up and down. So down means we consume a resource, and so this means, but if there is no resource, then I have to wait. So that's kind of the idea. So therefore, down receives a semaphore as a parameter, and a reference to a semaphore, to be precise. Then it kind of takes the mutex inside the semaphore and locks it. Yeah, so that's the first thing. And then, so it wants to have exclusive access to the semaphore. So therefore, that is the reason why we have this lock there. And then we do the count, the decrement. And now, if there are, how do I detect whether there are all resources are exhausted? This happens if the counter was zero before the down operation. So this means when I have decremented the counter, then if I'm in the negative, there are no resources. So now what do I have to do? So then I have to wait. And the key point here, yeah, then I have to wait. And the key thing to observe is that I do decrement the counter nonetheless, if there is a resource or if there is no resource. So this is important because by this kind of protocol, the counter has extra information. It does not only tell us how many free resources are available, but it also tells us how many extra resources might be demanded if they were there. So in this sense, they also count in the negative, they count the length of the waiting queue. And this is important because then I can, this is will be important for the signaling, because the signaling will then, we will always know whether signal, whether there is somebody. We will never issue a signal if we know there is no threat to wait. Only if there is someone waiting, we will do the signaling, and by that we kind of enforce that no signal is lost. And so this is kind of, and so therefore I like this protocol very much. Typically, just doing one signal, you typically, without being very careful, you never know whether there is somebody waiting or not, and whether your signal will be lost or not. But here you can be sure it will not be lost because of this assumptions about the counter. Okay? So that's kind of for the waiting. And otherwise, now we wait. And now after having returned from waiting, we kind of just continue. And that means in the very end, we only have to do the unlocking. And so this unlocking is done anyway. And recall that the so this waiting is kind of executed inside a lock-unlock block for the same mutex. And that is also essential for the protocol because the wait will, if you execute the, if you have to wait, then you do automatically an unlock of the mutex. And when you come back from the waiting and kind of get ready again, then you have to acquire the lock. That means in this kind of particular case at runtime, and also in the virtual machine instructions which we generate, we have to make sure that the lock is unlocked and then acquired again. And that means before this, whenever we reach this red block down there, we can be sure we have the lock. And then we can do the unlock. So there's no unlocking without locking. So this is therefore a perfect protocol, but it, we see also that it is brittle. And so you can make it quite wrong. And I must say, when I tried kind of to dream up, so I had read about this semaphore thing, and then I sat down, okay, so now I write the semaphore, and I made this protocol, I don't know, five times or so wrong. So, and until in the end it worked. Okay, so here is the translation. So here is not about correctness of implementation, but kind of correctness of translation. How would we translate that beast? But now, so that is kind of, again, so we are happy for our translation schemes because it's now just, as we see, generating code is not so difficult. So the first thing what we have to do is to do this assignment. So what is it? S is the parameter. We have to kind of dereference, so we get the, have to get the... and then kind of do the, so the value of S is the address, and then we have to add the decrement to get the M, and that is M is then stored at the ME, and that is then stored in the local variable ME. So this happens here. So here we allocate the single local variable ME. Here we get hold of the formal of the value of the formal parameter, and that's already the address. No, that's and why do I have to do a load? Load R minus 2. This is the address. Ah, yes, and then that is the address. And now I have to get the, actually I have to add now the decrement, the offset, but the offset of the mutex is zero. So I just now have, so that is the address of the pointer to the mutex. So I have to get the value from there. This is this load. By loading, I get now the reference to the mutex, and this I store in the local variable with relative address 1. So therefore, this store error. Now I have to, in fact, I would have to insert here in this place a pop, because I've done the assignment, and then load relative from 1 in order to do the locking in the next step. So you see here, the following instruction here is lock the translation, the implementation of this lock thing. Now it's the same ME which was assigned before. So therefore, I just, instead of popping and loading again, and now I was too lazy to spell it out, I just leave it, do not pop, and so I keep it on top of the stack and just do the lock immediately. So therefore, this code. So sorry, it's not according to the schemes, but according to the scheme, and then a little bit of optimization. okay. So now the next thing is that, let us go back. What is the next? We did the locking. Now we have to decrement the counter. So here is, again, we have to get hold of the S, the formal parameter. So this is the address to the address of the semaphore. Then we have to add to get to the second component. That is, we have to this address, we have to increment it by 2. So this happens here. Now we have the address of the counter. Now we load to get the value of the counter. Now we get the 1 to get to decrement. We subtract. And now we have to store it back. So that means, again, we have since the scheme code generation is a bit stupid, we have again to reconstruct the address of the counter, which is this done by that. Now this is the address of the counter, and then we have to just do the store. The store, and that kind of stores the counter inside the semaphore, and leaves it on top of the stack. And we would have to pop it, and we would have to load it again. See, we have to load it again in order to check it for non-zeroness. And so I was again too exhausted to recompute the address again and kind of load from that place. Instead, I just keep the value on stack. I keep the value and do not pop it, and therefore I have it here in this place. I would have to pop and then load again the address of the semaphore, add 2, and load the value from there in order to compare it with 2. And this I have optimized away. So that makes the code a bit shorter, and we see by that I think I have told that story many times, but you see here, as soon as you start to generate code for real programs, then you immediately see that there are stupid things going on, and there's room for optimization, and rooms for optimization which a real compiler will exploit, but which is difficult to formulate into the code generation schemes, because you cannot kind of change the scheme only depending whether you store in some address, whether the same address is kind of used again. Then you do not just pop the value, but keep it on stack. These kind of special cases, one would not obfuscate the simple code generation by such kind of reasoning, but kind of apply post-processing to do so. Okay, so there's one more thing here. This is some of these inefficiencies is also due to that we have a stack machine. If you have do not go generation for a stack machine but for a register machine, you have created the address in some register and then used this register, and then you will see that the same register will be computed a second time, and then there are standard optimizations which we typically discuss here in this lecture on program optimization, which will show you that the same expression is evaluated a second time, and that therefore instead of recomputing you just reuse the old register. So that is a kind of very classical compiler optimizations which will do this type of optimization for you, so that you do not have to do any ad hoc things. But here I did it quite ad hocly, just to shorten the sequence you have to look at. So now we have the test. Now then, after the test, for negativity of the counter, if it is not negative, then we proceed with A. Otherwise, if it is, so now we are in the then part, and in the then part we decided to wait. And we wait for the condition variable and the mutex. So we have to put the condition variable and the mutex on top of the stack. So first we may try to, loading the local variable, we put the mutex on top of the stack. Now then we have to access the condition variable. The condition variable is inside the semaphore at relative address 1. So we load the address of the condition variable, of the semaphore, we add 1. Now we have the address of the condition, of the pointer to the condition variable, and we load from there, so we get now the address of the condition variable on top of the stack. So, and then, now we have the situation where we can execute our little favorite sequence of instructions to implement the wait. The wait function from our condition variable. So this wait thing consisted of these 5 instructions. Wait, in order to put ourselves into the queue of the condition variable, then to duplicate the reference to the mutex, then unlock to give way for another thread to proceed, and this is for the unlocking, and then next to kind of schedule the next kind of stop the own thread and kind of give up save the own thread environment and switching to the next thread environment, and then hoping that former or later, then here in this somebody else rescues us out of the waiting queue and puts us into the ready queue again, so then we would proceed with the lock. Yeah, and so if nobody comes, nobody will increment the semaphore, we will kind of wait forever inside at the condition variable, too bad. Yeah? But otherwise, we will then next execute the lock. Okay? So then we have again the lock and proceed after the wait. So that was that thing, and now comes the regular part in the where we kind of proceed. So it's one-sided if, so that the A therefore is just the code, the start address of the code after this conditional statement, and there we just have to what do we have to do there? So we have to do the unlocking simply. The unlocking, so where is the mutex? The mutex is in local variable with relative address 1. So we load from there. Now we have the reference of the mutex on top of the stack, and then we do the unlocking. And then we are done. That's it. Okay? So you see, there is just this blue block, this is the implementation of the wait, nested into very standard code up to the operations lock and unlock, which we have to, where is my super duper lock operation? That was the wait. Ah, yes, here. So this was the lock thing and the unlock thing. And besides these and the blue block, everything is quite standard. Treatment of pointers and stuff, instructs. Is there a question? So that was when we tried to acquire a resource. Now the next thing is if we have acquired the resource, then at some point we are done with our work and we would give up the resource again. So this giving up the resource will increment the counter. The idea of the instruction up, which is in this sense complementary to the instruction down. So what do we expect here? So this up is an operation again executed for the semaphore. So the first thing, so again we, at least I suggest that we again store the mutex out of the semaphore inside the local variable ME. Why do I store it? Because I use it several times, and so therefore it makes sense to everything which one uses several times might be useful to have a local variable for. So here in this case, one might wonder whether one might also use this the counter local variable for the counter. But for some reason, I found it more convenient to have that, to avoid that. But that's a matter of taste. Now let us see what we do. So the first thing again, so our in the operation of the up should be again kind of atomic. So therefore we use the lock. We need locking the mutex. And so that happens here, and we unlock it here. So then, what do we do in between? So the key thing is that we increment the counter, and we do it nonetheless, what happens, disregarding everything. So every up will increment the counter, as every down decremented the counter. So now, by the way, this is a little bit problematic. Why? The question is whether one would like to have a semaphore with a try lock or a try up or a try down. That would be one thing, but there's another problematic thing here.
It's redundant atomically.
Hmm?
It's redundant atomically. But this is
achievable. Why? What has to be done atomically?
The increment version.
No, that's not true because it's inside the lock. So it's a protected area.
Yeah, sure.
So, but there's still a problematic thing. At least in a theoretical setting, you might see that this semaphore may fail, may be wrong, completely wrong, and result in complete mess. So in some sense, it is completely incorrect. Yeah, there could be arithmetic overflow, and we do not protect against that. So in this sense, it's very unsafe code, if you like. So on the other hand, so it's very rare that you have... In particular, if you have 64-bit integers, it's very rare that you have as many threads which all compete for the same semaphore or the same resources. But in a set, so this code only works fine if there are not too many threads. So that at least we should keep in mind. These are all these stupid overflows which we like to ignore, or at least I like to ignore, because I think of integers as infinite, but it's not true, so they are not infinite. So therefore we have a little bit of a problem here, which typically does not show up. Okay, so that was for the unconditional incrementing. One never should kind of, in very safe code, You never should kind of just increment the number. You always should check whether this, how large this number is, before you increment. Okay, so that was, so here we did, do not check, but we just increment. Okay, so now, if the counter was zero or larger, then nobody is waiting and we just increment. So, but if it, what happens if the, before we increment. But if there was somebody waiting, how do we identify whether somebody is waiting? Well, we identify it when incrementing results in a value which is zero or less. Yeah? Zero or less. If it's zero, then there was at least, there was exactly one waiting, which now gets the, and the resource is increased. So, but if it's after the increase, it is zero or less, then we know there is, the queue was not empty, and now should be kind of after the, after terminating of the app, should have decreased by one, because otherwise kind of our global invariant is broken. Yeah? So therefore, in this case, we have to signal. And the signaling, there will be some thread inside waiting. There will a wake up of this wake up call for this thread, and this thread will be moved into the ready queue. And then the invariant is again, whenever the signal is finished and the unlock is executed, the invariant will be reestablished. Okay? So that's kind of the idea. And so, sorry that I repeat myself, but due to this test, before, we are sure this signal will find a waiting thread. And it is not lost. It is definitely not lost. There could be other threads in between, which also do the up operations. But since the locking, this, the up operation is atomic, so in between, the counter will not change. Yeah? So the counter, it could be that the one which is the thread which is signaled is in the ready queue and was not able to run, but still it is no longer in the condition variable, and therefore if somebody else performs an up, it will kind of decrease, shrink the waiting queue in the condition variable. Yeah? But the counter is always after the unlock, when this up operation is completely terminated, the counter again faithfully indicates the number of waiting threads. Okay? So now let us just, so that was kind of the stupid repetition in some sense of this semaphore implementation, which I probably, how often have you kind of been explained the semaphore so far? How often? Three times, four times? Five? Oh. Then I should not have explained it to you. Sorry. Two times only. Okay, but I guess two times is okay. Or so. Okay, so now, but you, it is important, in some sense it is important, at least I find it I find it a nice lesson to understand that how subtle one has to be with this, with the thread communication. So it's not so easy. Okay, so now, but then comes, so forgive me that I explained it in detail again, but we want to implement it and let's see what we have to do. But so the first two things are similar to what we have seen, these two things, only that we increment instead of decrementing, and here we test again, and here again we'll do this optimization of not recomputing the address and loading again of the counter thing. So this means here is the allocation of the local variable, the storing of the mutex, leaving it on stack in order to do the locking. So now we have the locking. Now we go for the counter. The counter is again is computed here, and here it is incremented. So that is incrementing of the counter, and then it is here it is stored. So now we have loaded incremented and then stored away into the semaphore, the counter, and now we kind of, instead of popping that address, popping that value which we have stored, we keep it on the stack, we compare it with zero, and if it is less or equal, that is, if some waiting, there is some waiting thread, we have to kind of call, do the signal. And otherwise, we jump to A, and A, where's my A? Ah, A, sorry, A is here. Okay, so that now the part which is kind of, which corresponds to the signaling is this one. And so what happens for the signal? So there we said we first have to kind of access the reference to the condition variable and put it on top of the stack. That is by the first four instructions here, which kind of take the actual parameter at relative address minus 2, increment it by 1, the value of it is the address of the semaphore. We add 1 to get the offset for the condition variable. We load from there to get the address of the condition variable. And now we have the condition variable which we signal. And signaling, what was it? Recall, this was a very simple operation. It just extracted one thread out of the waiting queue and puts it into the ready queue. That was all what signaling did, and no more. Yeah? So signal was very simple. And then now after having done the... Now we are at the behind the conditional statement where we have only to do the unlock. And the unlocking, therefore we load then the reference to the mutex and do our super-duper instruction unlock, and that's it. And then we are done. Okay? So in this sense, it's easy code. Okay, so that's kind of, by that we have, I don't know how much we have seen by that, only that code generation, multi-threaded or not, is not much more difficult. In this sense, we are now done with our machine. I may point out there is that this virtual machine is nice, but it has a little bit of a problem in that if you have really POSIX threads, then the thread create and the mutex pthread mutex lock and pthread mutex unlock and also these waiting and signaling, these are just C functions. So you could have pointers to them, and so you really have to deal them as functions. Here we kind of use them as built-ins, as kind of part of the language. So in that sense, if we want to make it a really realistic, use them for a realistic implementation of C functions, of POSIX threads, we have to wrap them. So in some sense, we have to kind of only implement it underscore pthread create, or so the worker operations, and would have to wrap them into C functions to make it really realistic. And one more thing, perhaps which I have already said, but it might be worthwhile repeating, the real pthread operations also have return values indicated with error codes, because things can go wrong. And we have seen, for example, I'm not sure whether for the semaphore up and down we might want to have a return value, namely, for example, if we check for overflow and there's an overflow, we could kind of indicate that by the return value. And that might be a good idea to make it in this sense safe, this instruction. Okay, so now let's go for, in principle we are now done with this lecture, but we could kind of have a final look at an open question which kind of occurred because we needed a super duper new data structure which allowed us to maintain an arbitrary number of stacks within our main store. And that is kind of a little bit of a problematic thing. So we might wonder how we can deal with that. And so that is kind of, that is perhaps a nice question. So this is kind of about implementing a runtime system for a multi-threading machine. So once again, what is the problem? All the threads live in the same storage, and every thread needs its own stack and must be able to allocate things on the stack and deallocate things on its stack. So we could deal with that by allocating, equipping each new thread with a fixed amount of storage. So everyone gets, say, 1 megabyte of stack space. And that is kind of not so bad, because if you think of that in a multi-threaded environment, it does not make very much sense to have deeply recursive functions. You would kind of use non-recursive functions, and then 1 megabyte of stack space will typically enough. And if you think of that, the number of threads that you have perhaps is 100, or say even if you have 100 threads and it's 100 megabyte of stack space, that's fine. Yeah, so if the you can afford it, yeah, so it's not so bad. And then this new stack operation which we have would then just mean you allocate this amount of stack space this in your main memory, and if you free it, you kind of free that amount of stack space. Oh, yeah, so that you could do. If one is either restricted in the main memory or wants to think of a system which might have a tremendously large amount of threads, because recall, our threads were cheap. So in this sense, this kind of supports a programming style where you create threads at will. So whenever there's a small task which you can do, you just generate a thread for it. So you could do it like that and then leave it to the operating system to maintain these many threads and kind of use it perhaps in a work balance between multiple cores or whatnot. So it might, so that it could be quite conceivable to have lots of threads. And then and some of these threads might consume much space and stack space because they are really hard working, and others use only little. That the problem is that this stack space is not known in advance, and you want to have your implementation in some sense robust, in that it is not easily crashed by only because one of the threads realizes a DFS through a graph, and the graph is sometimes small and sometimes large, and when it's large, suddenly the thread crashes. So probably you do not want to have that. Yeah? So that is what can we do, and here is now another suggestion what we might do. And that is we do not consider separate stack data structures, but kind of a joint data structure for all stacks. And that data structure we might call a frame heap. So the frame heap consists of just individual frames. It's a collection of frames, stack frames, for each recursive call, if you like, of a procedure. So that each stack frame, therefore, is only sufficient for the current function call, so that we can statically enforce. And then we kind of, when a new function call occurs in any thread, we just allocate it in the same frame heap. So it's just, if you like, one stack. Only that when a function returns, we may not necessarily pop the stack, because there could be more frames on top of this this kind of finished procedure call from other threads. So in some sense, this reminds us a little bit to what happened in the Prolog machine. There we also had kind of multiple, we could not necessarily pop the stack when a procedure was terminated. So that would then also be the case here. So then we have also a global stack pointer, which points to the overall topmost stack element. So it would be this one, And so here we, you see there are two threads which run concurrently, and they have allocated stack frames, and they are not kind of in sequence. So sometimes they are, sometimes they are not. And the frame pointer, the old frame pointer, always points to the last stack frame, and so everything is fine. So by that, they are kind of by this, by the old stack frame pointer, they might kind of be linked together, the different stack frames. So if we do a new, if we want to do a new stack frame, so that means we kind of this when we allocate a new stack frame, it is no longer possible that we just increment the SP, because our stack pointer might be, so let us think of, we are the blue thread, then the blue stack pointer would be here, and now we want to allocate a new frame. We cannot kind of increment the stack pointer, because then we would hit into the yellow stack space. So, but we can kind of use the global stack pointer to allocate then a new stack frame here. Yeah, and we, for that we have to know only how large the stack frame is, and we have to return there, record there the kind of link to where the old where we have to where the new top of stack is after we have popped the stack frame. So. Now, then, this is the new stack frame. Now, then when we free a stack frame, okay. So we also have to do something. So what do we have to do? When can we free? So allocating a stack frame is easy. Freeing is not so easy. Because free, if the free the well. Freeing could be easy if the stack frame is on top of the stack, because then we just decrement the stack, the GSP and the stack pointer, and by that we free. A little bit of caution is now in place, because it is not necessarily so that that stack frame which has been allocated the last will be released as the earliest, at the earliest possible moment. And so therefore, it could happen. Why? Because other threads might have kind of buried our stack, current stack frame by more stack frames. And if we are done here, then this does not mean that the other thread will be done with its recursive call. So therefore, there could be now deallocated blocks inside the stack. So that means we now have a stack with holes. So in that sense, it could kind of happen that after some time, there are a lot of garbage, if you like. But on the other hand, it's not garbage in the sense of as we had it for dynamically allocated data structures, because now we always know at every time point whether a block is live or is dead. And it cannot happen that there is kind of an indirect deadness, so to speak, that we are only pointed to by a dead block. This cannot happen because we first, yeah, so in this sense it's better than we are better off than in a, in for arbitrary dynamic data structures. So is it clear? Yeah, because otherwise you could deallocate a full list consisting of a lot of blocks, and so that the last block is also garbage, you only see once you have kind of freed all the blocks before. But here we always free at the end. So in that sense it's easier. And what we can do is we could maintain a list of freed stack blocks. Yeah, and these list of freed stack blocks could kind of contain the start address and the end address of inside the stack, which are no longer occupied, and which when we free a block, then we could kind of insert that block into this list. And if a block is on the and inserted in the list, it's kind of in the right place, so we can keep this list sorted, if you like, so that kind of the topmost blocks are at the front of the list and the bottommost empty blocks are down there. And that means that allows us, if the block on the topmost block is freed, we can check in this list whether the next block can also be freed. And then we can free as many blocks as we like until everything is and we arrive at the next occupied block. So that is one thing which we can do. And the other thing is, when we insert a block, we can check whether the neighboring blocks have already been freed and kind of merge blocks. So by that, we kind of only keep non-neighboring free blocks inside this list. Yeah, so that's kind of graphically, if we free a block, so here the block on top of the stack, then okay, so then it's just thrown away. And if we free a block inside which has a neighboring free block, then we kind of merge. So here these two blocks here are kind of joined together to form this new larger free block. So by that we kind of can keep a little bit of our data structure compact. So the list of free blocks we can kind of keep shrink, not to have too many small elements, and we also hopefully can make the maintenance of this, the overall data structure, cheaper. So now the question is, when do we allocate these fresh blocks onto this data structure? So that is kind of the thing. One thing which we could do is we allocate at every function call. The problem is, when we allocate that block before the function call, then we cannot do it because we don't know how much stack space the function will use. So we actually can only, the best thing is to allocate the block after having entered the function body. So doing it together with this alloc thing. Yeah? So that is, this means that the organizational cells as well as the actual parameters have been allocated in the old block. And it's only for the locals and for the locals and the local stack space that we allocate a new block. Yeah? Okay. So this means the actual parameters, so this kind of here, this zone, if you like, which I make now yellow, this is all the inside the block of the caller, if you like. And there you will put inside the actual parameters and the organizational cells. And then inside the local variables, they are all inside the new block. And so we note now that the frame pointer and the stack pointer point to different blocks. And so that's kind of a good idea, because the frame pointer is in this sense, in this way, allows us to access kind of the old block, which might be arbitrarily far away from the block where the locals are. So we are happy that we have these two pointers. So extreme, we have no extreme pointer. Yeah, so, but still, we need, yes. Sure. we need to know to determine the static stack space, but there, the number of actual parameters together with the number of organizational cells are literally statically inside the code. So we see them.
No,
yes.
That depends on the function we call.
No. We call function f. Inside the function f, we don't know how many actual parameters are provided. But outside the f, the caller knows, because he hands over seven arguments.
No, we don't know which function gets called.
That doesn't matter. But we see the actual parameters, because we have written them onto the stack.
Okay, so we find the maximum of all calls inside the function, the current function?
Yes, the current function. The current function sees all its calls. All calls which itself, in the code of the current function, we see there is a call with 5 parameters, with 6, with 7, and with 8. And we don't know the function which is called because it's dynamic, but we know the number of parameters, and we know therefore how much space we need. But it's clearly a tricky thing, so we must be we must always be sure what do we know statically. Can we kind of provide this an upper bound to the size? It's a little bit problematic as soon as if one has a stack allocated arrays of unknown size, then we are doomed. And then this would not work. So we either rule it out or we kind of provide it in an extra block. Okay. So, but the, in this sense, now we are, at least we are happy that the frame pointer points to the old, block and the stack pointer to the new one.
In this way, we need to change our way of assessing the local parameters, right?
Yes. So the local, now we are kind of in, we are in a good shape for accessing the parameters. We do it with respect to the frame pointer. We are in a bad shape for accessing our locals because they are not, we don't know how far apart they are from the frame pointer. So, but for that, I kind of have indicated that you can do it relative to the stack pointer anyway. And then now we would do it with relative to the stack pointer. Okay, so that would be, that would mean that we have to reorganize the complete code generation. I would see that as a minor problem, but you might be unhappy about it because then you kind of switching from single-threaded to multi-threaded, you have to change your code generation scheme. And what happens if they one function in the according to one in a multi-threaded environment calls one of a single-threaded environment, and it's not so clear whether that always cooperates well. So either we do it all the way for all our for all our code to do the code generation in that way, or we kind of do something else.
What if we put the locals in the old stack frame?
But we don't know how many because we don't know which function is called. That we do here. So the caller has no way to statically know how much stack space it will need.
What if we introduce an extra digit in addition to SP or FP, which points to the bottom of the local variables, and then modify a node R to operate on this or negative, and the other positive?
Yeah, that you could do, but that again means changing the code generation, only that the calculation is kind of simplified. Or here what I also kind of can envision, so there are many solutions. The question is what is the best and what is practical and what is feasible. One thing is, and what in real compilers is, and in real architectures is kind of the default, is that parameters are passed in registers. And then you kind of pass them in registers. You do not need them, put them into the old, and you do not need to put them into the old stack into the old frame, but can put all of them into the new one, into the new frame. Yeah? And that is kind of... But that is only possible if the parameters, the number, the size of the parameters is kind of bounded. If you kind of have an array inside a struct, and that could be arbitrarily large, you can pass arbitrarily many data into the new function, and then your 32 registers might be exhausted, and then you are doomed equally well. But then clearly, again, there are is always ways around. If then you statically see that this that there is a function call which receives 1,000 byte as parameters, which cannot be passed in registers, then you could kind of use some kind of scratchpad memory to pass the that and then copy it onto the new. So there is always a way around. So in some sense, but for the usual functions, you typically will never see that. And so in that sense, the scratchpad is typically not used, but it is there in the case of emergency. So that is things which one can do. Okay, and then also, there's one more thing. You have the frame pointer and the stack pointer in different frames, then this is nice because you do not have to, because then the return value will be in the old frame and you access it by means of the frame pointer. So that's good. You don't need a pointer where to return the value. Otherwise, when everything, all the data of the new call are in a separate block, you have to kind of store a pointer back to the block where you have to return your value. Yeah? Because then you cannot put into the stack space of your actual parameters because that's the wrong block. So they are demanded in another block. So you have to kind of move it over. Yeah? So therefore, this is the best idea is really that one where you kind of separate the parameters in the and the organizational cells for the old block and the locals and every local information in the new block. That is kind of the ideal, I would say, the ideal separation of concerns. Okay, so then there is... So this is kind of nice in some sense as you kind of separate the treatment of all the stack frames. And but that is perhaps you would like to have a more stack-like behavior of the of your stack management, and so one could use something which is perhaps a bit boring, but which might be still a very good idea is you use kind of a hybrid solution. This means you have K, and K is an arbitrary bound which you kind of might have adjust as a compiler option, say 32, and so they get a lot of stack space. And that is as long as your number of threads is less than 32, everyone gets its own memory segment and can do there a lot of, can consume a lot of stack space there. And only once you have many threads, then you start to share stacks by putting them, and then you can decide even where to put them, perhaps at that places where not where there's the most stack space still available. And by that you kind of can try to adjust by the extra arriving threads, adjust the balancing between the thread groups, if you like, for memory consumption. Yeah, and that means for few threads, the advantage is that for few threads, the thing is simple and efficient because you don't have to maintain this block management and free blocks and all that stupid stuff, you don't have to care about it. It will simply work as if it were stacks. And if there are many threads, then okay, then you have to pay the price. And since there, if there are many threads, then there's a lot of frames being allocated, and then the different stacks will be balanced, and everything behaves as if it were, if it were kind of equally distributed. And in that sense, you could even think of that. In this kind of, if you have these multiple stacks, this is also would also be amenable to at least to my intuition, to a multi-core implementation of this virtual machine, because then you could have one stack managed by one worker thread. So all the threads sitting for, is it like that? At least the stack management of each stack could then be done by a separate thread. And so they would be independent, and it would not be that the management of one stack slows down the work of other threads in operating on a completely different stack. So this kind of is a, in this sense, this would then be a shared, could be used as the starting point of a distributed implementation of this multi-threaded virtual machine.
This intertwined stack frame solution, do we care about fragmentation? Because in the worst case, we have enough, if we start, for example, with two threads which call functions which use only a small amount of stacks, and at some point we switch to functions which use a huge amount of stacks, and we did not correctly delete the
yes.
Or free the other stack frames, then we come into trouble.
We could come into trouble, yes. So, but that would mean that, so there could be fragmentation, and this could be a serious problem. So there's two things. First, the number of blocks we try to keep small by kind of combining adjacent free blocks. And the hope is that kind of in the long run, the stack space kind of goes, that the stack movement, the change in the stack height, is sufficiently variable, so that all the holes, former or later, are freed. But there is the danger of fragmentation, definitely. But on the other hand, since the overall amount, then you can, for this kind of joint data structure, you can allocate a huge chunk. So that's, in this sense, you have much more things to waste. And you must see that since we do not do garbage collection here, we save some time. That is one thing. And we do not need, if you, this extra to and from space, which would half the amount of space which we have at hand. So in that sense, we could afford that the 50% of all our stack space is empty. That would kind of still be decent before we would start to fully garbage collect it with compression and all that stuff. Okay, so that kind of terminates the lecture. I hope you understand that this is kind of just ideas how you could implement such a thing. So it's not kind of something which one should learn by heart. So that is not the solution, and there is no other solution. But this is kind of an idea how you could do it, and kind of what kind of things you might take in mind, have to keep in mind when you design such a runtime system for a virtual machine. And in that sense, this is not so virtual as anymore, because there you really, in a real machine, you might have generate code for native code, but still you would have to provide a data structure to maintain the joint shared stacks, because that one can't do without. So I hope you enjoyed the lecture at least as much as I. And so then, thank you.